This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, President Obama says no to the Keystone XL pipeline, saying the project is not in the national interests of the United States. After years of secret negotiations, the text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal is now public. We'll take a look at some of the fine print. And we go to Yemen, where a devastating cyclone added to the destruction wrought by 8 months of continuous airstrikes. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. President Barack Obama made his highly anticipated and long-awaited announcement on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline.
The State Department has decided that the Keystone XL pipeline would not serve the national interests of the United States. I agree with that decision.
The announcement comes just days after TransCanada made a last-ditch effort to save the project, asking the State Department to pause the permit review process, a request the State Department denied. Many observers of the contentious multi-year process saw it as an attempt by the company to dodge the final no President Obama delivered Friday.
This pipeline would neither be a silver bullet for the economy, as was promised by some, nor the express lane to climate disaster proclaimed by others.
Obama said the Keystone pipeline would not create jobs or reduce gas prices, that shipping dirtier crude oil through the country would not increase U.S. energy security, and that approving the pipeline would have undercut what he called the U.S. role as a global leader on climate change. Environmentalists are celebrating the rejection of the pipeline permit, which comes just weeks ahead of a U.N. climate summit in Paris. But others argue that the fuel will find its way to market one way or another, and moving oil by rail has become an increasingly common method. In Oregon this week, the Portland City Council approved a resolution opposing any increase in oil train traffic through the city. And in Western Washington, Stand Up to Oil, Communities Fueling Change, is saying shell no to the oil giant's plans to build a rail spur for its Puget Sound refinery. FSRN's Martha Baskin has more.
Royal Dutch Shell's proposal to transport some 60,000 barrels of crude a day by rail from the Bakken shale fields to the coast of Washington state has renewed concerns about what many have dubbed moving time bombs. 15 oil-by-rail terminals are either proposed, under construction, or already operating in the Pacific Northwest. If all reach operational capacity, 100 oil trains, some up to a mile in length, will run through the area every week.
No oil trains, no way!
One more time,
no oil trains, no way!
After years of derailments and a deadly explosion that killed 47 in Canada 2 years ago, environmentalists in Western Washington succeeded in delaying Shell's proposal by getting the state and county to conduct an environmental review, a first for an oil refinery in the state. Timothy Hahn was among the local residents who spoke at a recent public hearing.
The trains have all kinds of inherent problems. They have derailment dangers and they're carrying a troubling cargo. But it's a place for us to pinch off the entire big picture.
Hahn and others are asking the state to look at the cumulative impacts of moving oil by rail, health, environmental, safety, as well as short and long-term climate consequences of burning and shipping fossil fuels. Hydraulic fracturing or fracking in the Bakken shale formation of North Dakota and Montana has swamped the capacity of pipelines and trucks to carry the crude to market. As a result, the nation's rail lines are picking up the slack, sometimes at the expense of commodities like wheat and apples that rely on rail to get to market. Between 2005 and 2013, the amount of oil traveling by rail from the Bakken increased nearly 40-fold, according to the U.S. Association of American Railroads. Today, more than 6 out of every 10 barrels from the Bakken is hauled to refineries by rail. A sizable portion goes to Washington because it's cheaper than sending it to the East Coast or even California. Analyst Eric DePlace with Seattle-based think tank Sightline says shipping oil by rail remains unsafe despite years of accidents.
And I think it's a really sort of terrifying irony that we treat the oil by rail industry in a way that we treat no other industry in America.
DePlace says if there's a battery pack fire on an airplane, the FAA grounds the planes until the problem is fixed. If there's an airbag deployment problem, the Transportation Department recalls the cars or forces the manufacturer to recall.
But an oil train industry can initiate explosion after explosion in cities all across North America, and the response is, well, we're going to get around to phasing these out over some period of years. And if you really kind of look at the details, we're actually never going to force you to stop using them at all.
DePlace points to a suite of federal laws that allows the railroad industry to skirt regulatory accountability and transparency mechanisms required for other methods of transportation. States like Washington, Minnesota, California, and others have noted difficulties in getting the Federal Railroad Administration to answer their information requests. A new state law in Washington requires the FRA to notify cities, counties, and fire departments before an oil train comes to their community. But due to wrangling over just what type of oil cargo requires advance notice, the system is not yet fully functional. In the meantime, the oil trains keep coming. Back at the public hearing for an environmental review of Shell's proposed rail spur, Jill Mangalimam with Got Green waits to testify. The nonprofit promotes a green economy for low-income and communities of color.
From coal trains to oil trains, these entities are still coming through our communities of color, low-income communities, through the International District, through South Park, through Georgetown. People are being impacted today. And so if we are serious about, you know, taking care of people's lives and our communities, we really need to drastically stop these trains.
A draft environmental impact statement on the proposed rail spur is expected in the spring, when public comments will again be considered. Shell is also actively lobbying to lift the three-decade-old export ban on U.S. crude. In an email, company spokesperson Ray Fisher said, "As a company that owns businesses along the crude oil value chain, we remain sensitive to all sides of this debate. However, we believe policies that help match supply with demand are beneficial to government, industry, and consumers alike." If the export ban is lifted, it could create even more economic pressure to expand the transportation of crude to coastal refineries positioned to supply foreign markets. The House of Representatives voted to lift the ban in early October. It's now the Senate's turn to consider the measure. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
The New Zealand government released the final text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement Thursday morning. The White House followed suit just hours later. The massive trade deal that includes 12 countries and 40% of the world's economy has been shrouded in secrecy until now. Parts of the deal have been leaked along the way, but it's the first time the public has had a chance to read what could become the most broad-reaching trade deal in history. The agreement has enormous implications for global labor, food and product safety, access to affordable medications, the environment, and much more. For a look at how the TPP could affect the internet, FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Evan Greer, campaign director of Fight for the Future.
The TPP contains extreme provisions that benefit copyright holders in ways that could lead to widespread internet censorship. It's very similar in scope to the very unpopular legislation SOPA that was resoundingly rejected several years ago. And essentially what it does is it forces the United States' broken copyright system on the rest of the world without expanding protections for freedom of speech and so-called fair use, which are basically provisions that prevent copyright from being used to censor or take down legitimate content or criticism or political dissidence from the internet. The TPP also undermines our anonymous ability to express ourselves online by requiring governments to keep a public database of real names and addresses associated with top-level domains such as .us or .ca if you're in Canada. This is really dangerous, particularly for the ability of opposition groups to speak out without fear of violent retribution. So that's just a few of the things that are in there. Another one I guess I'd quickly point out is that it criminalizes, or further criminalizes, rather, whistleblowers like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, and potentially could even make it illegal for journalists to report on documents that whistleblowers expose. So really, through and through, the TPP is threatening not only to the internet and our online free speech, but really to democracy as a whole.
And this text is coming to light right after the U.S. Senate passed an internet bill last week known as CISA. And both Mexico and the U.K. introduced new internet legislation this week. Do you think these legislative movements, all within a week of each other, are part of efforts to bring national laws into compliance with the terms of the TPP?
You know, I think there's a battle raging right now for the future of the internet in general. And both governments and large corporations and even non-governmental institutions like the UN are all vying for control over this platform. And I think what's critical is that internet users around the world recognize the truly democratic potential that the internet has and the power that it gives ordinary people to speak out and affect their governments. And I think that it's something that we need to fight to defend regardless of which governments are attacking it. The internet knows no borders, and internet users need to unite around the world to fight these types of policies.
President Barack Obama has already indicated he plans to sign the deal, but first it goes to Congress for an up or down vote. Groups like Fight for the Future are gearing up for an 11th-hour push to stop the trade deal before it can get to the president's desk. You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. Heavy rains in Yemen added to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in the war-torn country this week. Cyclone Chapala made landfall Tuesday, bringing with it massive rainfall to the country where more than 2.3 million people are internally displaced. A Saudi-led coalition of 11 Gulf monarchies, supported by the U.S., has continuously carried out airstrikes in the country since March. The multifaceted conflict erupted following a healthy takeover of the central government led by President Abrabu Mansour Hadi. Saif al-Alibi is a freelance journalist and translator at the Yemen Observer. He's based in Sana'a and joins us by telephone from the capital city. First, the Saudis claim the ongoing military intervention is aimed at repelling the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. Have they had any success in pushing the Houthis back?
It's been now 8 months, but Saudi Arabia and its allies have achieved nothing of their stated goals. They said the campaign would be sharp and quick, but now it's been 8 months. All they're doing is that they're targeting civilians, that's all.
Many call this a proxy war and cite Iran's support of the Houthis. Is Iran tangibly supporting the Houthi rebels?
This support couldn't be confirmed directly. And Saudi Arabia is claiming that Iran is backing the Houthi rebels, and it's playing this card to destroy Yemen. Saudi Arabia is losing its dominance over Yemen, and they're just taking this pretext under which they attack Yemen. They're not attacking Houthis, they're actually attacking Yemen. Iran actually, on one hand, it's supporting the Houthis, but not as it's claimed by the media outlets that they are sending weapons to Houthis. And in terms of financial support, they cannot, because the blockades imposed by the Saudi-led coalition is preventing them from getting any kind of support.
Amid this ongoing aerial campaign and humanitarian crisis, the country was deluged by uncommon and very heavy rains this week when Cyclone Chapala made landfall. How did that affect the continuing crisis in Yemen?
Well, I think the situation has become worse and worse. People are dying here in Yemen without any medical care. And this Cyclone Chapala has brought a disaster for the people who are already in hell. Yemenis are dying. They cannot find even the basic medical needs. And with this disaster, the floods are sweeping all the coastal cities. Now more than 40,000 people are homeless. Their houses have been completely destroyed. Everything has been destroyed in the coastal cities.
You traveled recently on a reporting trip, leaving Yemen's Gulf Coast, where another crisis is unfolding as refugees from Ethiopia and Somalia arrive on the shores, and heading north through the country to Sada'a at the far northern border with Saudi Arabia. What did you find along the way? And why are African refugees fleeing to a country that is itself in the midst of an aerial bombardment campaign?
There were long vehicles, oil vehicles, like cars of civilian citizens were bombed. They were there scattered in the streets. As we arrived to the town itself, everything is demolished. Houses, hospitals, governmental institutions, banks. Sada is, I cannot even describe the damages that I have seen all the way to Sada and when I arrived there. I'm really, really surprised a few people are still there. But when I asked one of the residents who was sitting along with his kids and wife under a tree, I told them, why are you staying here? Well, you should have left. He said, we have nowhere to go. And about the refugees, the African refugees, Somalis, I think what they face in their countries is different. There are militias who slaughter people. Here, there are only bombs. So that's why they sold shelter here in Yemen.
Talks between the Houthis and the Mansour Hadi government were reportedly set to happen last weekend. Did those talks take place? And what's next for the peace process and for the people of Yemen?
Peace talks were set in Geneva, but they were doomed to failure, the same as every time. Because the warring parties, no one is paying responsibility for the civilian death toll. No one is talking about the seriousness of now the only beneficiary of this conflict is Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is extending its ground control over the southern parts of the country. And now they're imposing a lot of rules. And this is the serious thing that all warring parties should pay attention to.
That's Saif Al-Alibi, a freelance journalist and translator for the Yemen Observer. He joined us by phone from Sana'a. Burmese democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi says if her party wins in Sunday's elections, she will circumvent the constitution and rule the country. The historic polls are part of democratic reform efforts Burma's military government made in recent years. The junta illegally seized power after losing parliamentary elections in 1990. But before new polls were promised, rulers in Burma, also known as Myanmar, banned the enormously popular Suu Kyi from serving as president. Patricia Noonan has more on Suu Kyi's constitutional end run from Yangon.
Aung San Suu Kyi says there's nothing in Burma's constitution to prevent her from assuming a post higher than that of president if her party, the National League for Democracy, wins.
We have somebody who is prepared to represent the NLD as a president, but I will make all the proper and important discussions and decisions with regard to government. I'll run the government, and we have a president who will work in accordance with the policies of the NLD.
The apparent note of defiance comes 3 days before Burmese voters go to the polls to elect 291 representatives in the 440-member body. Burma's constitution, controversially enacted in 2008, has a clause banning those with foreign-born children from assuming the office of the presidency, a move seen as specifically targeting Suu Kyi. Her late husband and her children are British. Suu Kyi is a democracy icon in Burma. She spent nearly 20 years in house arrest for speaking out against the military dictatorship. During that time, she won the Nobel Peace Prize. She was released in 2010. Burma's military rulers changed the country's name to Myanmar in 1989, a decision not universally recognized. Their willingness to enact democratic reform remains limited, since no matter who wins the polls, 25% of parliamentary seats are reserved for the military. Patricia Noonan, FSRN, Yangon.
This week, noted Indian human rights activist Irom Sharmila marked 15 years of what is perhaps the longest hunger strike in history. Sharmila is demanding that lawmakers in India repeal a draconian law that gives security forces wide powers to fight insurgency in the northeastern states and Kashmir. As Bismillah Gilani reports, Hundreds of Sharmila's supporters took to the streets in several Indian cities in solidarity with her struggle.
Hundreds of students, human rights activists, and civil society organizations joined marches and solidarity fasts to mark the 15th anniversary of Irom Sharmila's continuous hunger strike against the controversial Armed Forces Special Powers Act, also known as AFSPA. Sharmila is being held against her will at a hospital, where authorities keep her alive by force-feeding her drugs and nutrients through a nasal tube. The protesters criticize the government for criminalizing Sharmila's peaceful struggle rather than publicly addressing the reasons behind her protest. P. Sundaram from the Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament was among the activists taking part in a solidarity fast in New Delhi.
Here's a lady who's brave, who is relentless, who has been sitting on this strike for 15 years, and the state has not responded to her. Not even a single proper dialogue has happened to her. On the contrary, you would see that the Indian state is always ready to have dialogues with underground groups, insurgent groups, armed groups. And if at all this means anything, it means that there's a huge challenge before our democracy. AFSPA is a very, very important, urgent issue which needs to be addressed, and it's very unfortunate that the government is not listening to people who are protesting peacefully.
43-year-old Irom Sharmila began her protest in the year 2000 after Indian Army killed 10 people in her hometown in the northeastern state of Manipur. She says she will end her fast only after the law that gives the Indian security forces sweeping powers and has led to widespread human rights abuses is repealed. Last year, a court in Manipur had ordered her release, ruling that her fast was a form of political protest and not necessarily a suicide attempt. It's a crime to attempt suicide in India, and the authorities had used the charge as a legal basis for her detention. But barely 2 days after her release, she was rearrested and again charged with the same offense. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. There's much to be said about cows, but being a security threat isn't often included. In 1987, however, in a small town near Bethlehem in the West Bank, Israeli authorities targeted 18 of the animals. Their crime? Providing Palestinians with milk to substitute for Israeli dairy and achieve some semblance of independence. FSRN's Delia Hatuka explains.
We are Palestinians. We deserve to have a home. We deserve to have our land. We deserve to have our freedom. And we deserve to have cows.
Dr. Majid Nassar is a physician from Beit Sahur, a West Bank town near Bethlehem. In the Wanted 18, Palestine's submission for the Best Foreign Language Film category at next year's Academy Awards, he recalls a time in the 1980s when his community bought a herd of cows, which Israel eventually dubbed a security threat. The animated documentary centers on the community's determination to become independent from Israel during the first Palestinian Intifada or uprising, and that involved civil disobedience. This included refusing to pay taxes to Israeli authorities. The film focuses on Beit Sahur's desire to become food independent as well, which meant boycotting Israeli goods. That's where the 18 cows come in. The community bought a herd from a sympathetic Israeli kibbutznik, and local milk began to flow to Palestinian homes. But Israeli authorities didn't like it one bit. Shalal Komsiyeh, who is featured in the documentary, recalls the day the cows became outlaws.
The military governor came one day with his soldiers to the farm. First thing they did there is to take a photo for each cow with its number on its body. And he told us in brief that we have to remove the cows and get rid of them. When I asked him why, he said, and I quote the exact words, "These cows are dangerous for the security of the state of Israel."
Filmmakers Amir Shomali, a Palestinian, and Paul Cowan from Britain weave dark humor throughout a series of archival footage, reenactments, and claymation segments to show the absurdity of the situation, which eventually led to the community hiding the cows, at one point even at the local butcher's house. Shomali, who hails from Beit Sahur, says the idea for the film came to him when he was still a child, growing up at the Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria, long before his family moved to Palestine.
One of the comic books I read in that refugee camp was a comic book about Beit Sahur, about the civil disobedience in Beit Sahur, the cows, the tax strike, and I was very excited. At that time, I was obsessed with reading comic books, and all the comic books I was reading about superheroes, Superman, Tintin, Batman, Asterix. And for me, reading a comic book about my town meant a lot. Like the first time I'm reading about superheroes who could be my relatives, my uncles, my aunts, and that means in a way or another that me, myself, can be a superhero by blood.
Shomali wanted to change preconceived notions people have about Palestinians. And he wanted to do so through what he calls the Trojan cows. He calls them that because audiences often find it easier to connect with the animals than with the Palestinian people.
We made the film in a way where the cows are the main voice in the film. So if you are pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli, anyway, you will let the cows lead you through this journey. They have beautiful eyes, they are interesting characters, and they are talking cows. So they lead you into this story, and through sympathizing with the cows, you start to understand what does it mean to live under occupation as Palestinians. And I say usually that in the West, it's easier for the audience to sympathize with the cow rather than sympathizing with the Palestinian. So we gave the cows a voice to represent us.
But Abba Allo, who watched the film, thought the use of dark humor to tell the tale of Beit Sahur took away from the serious and tragic parts of the story.
There was a lot of funny parts, which kind of lost the sincerity for me. I focused more on the joke rather than the actual topic. The message is sent in a simple way, but the pain is a lot deeper.
The Academy Award nominations won't be announced for another few months. In the meantime, the filmmakers are working on French and Japanese versions of The Wanted 18 to make the movie as widely accessible as possible. Dalia Hatuka, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
And that does it for this week's program. Before we go, we'd like to welcome the Radio Phoenix community to the FSRN fold. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work and to find extended interviews, downloadable audio, and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is Nos, Keneal, and Alexel via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.